How outrageous was the recent incursion by Russian troops into Crimea following the removal of Ukrainian President Yanukovych from power? What can be read into the military movements and public pronouncements by both Russia and major Western powers? Are we in the lead-up to another Cold War? Rick Rozoff of Stop NATO offers his thoughts in the first half hour. Is the Crimean referendum on independence at all comparable to the two previous Quebec referenda on independence from Canada? Retired University of Winnipeg geography professor John Ryan thinks so and explains his view in the second half hour to give us his take. And what are the differences and similarities between the media campaign around Ukraine and those of previous targets of NATO aggression, such as Iraq and Syria? Longtime freelance journalist and global research contributor Felicity Arbuthnot will join us later in the show to give us her take. On today's program, Russia, Crimea, and the mighty Wurlitzer, countdown to war? Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of March 14th, 2014. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. There is increasing skepticism in both the social and corporate media about the credibility of 9/11 as the foundation for the continuing global war on terror. Last year, President Obama was prevented from waging, on grounds of state terrorism, war with Syria. As of March 2014, seven congressmen backed by impacted 9/11 families are calling for the release of a secret 2002 congressional study that implicates Saudi Arabia in financing the alleged hijackers. The tale of 19 hijackers is viewed more and more as a construct and the reality that it created as a contrived perception. If there is one force with the power to reverse this perception, it is the dynamic Rethink 911 campaign, which has taken hold strongly in the U.S. and Canada and has plans to expand into Britain and other countries. That's from the article, The 9/11 Attacks, Keeping the Lid on the Lie, Media Response to the Growing Influence of the 9/11 Truth Movement by Elizabeth Woodworth, posted March 12th. To return to your question, I think what could occur in the immediate future are actions by the Ukrainian forces controlled by the neo-Nazis. This is more of a creating instability scenario of creating a continued chaos. I should mention that one component of the scenario is the impoverishment of the Ukrainian population under the brunt of the Western creditors and the IMF. The country will be going into a situation of an increased debt, which will be coupled with conditions which invariably mean the freeze of wages, austerity measures, and so on. In other words, the scenario of economic collapse is already ongoing. That's from the article, Ukraine, the Worst Case Scenario is World War III, by Michel Chosudovsky, posted March 12th, transcribed from an interview with Voice of Russia. Washington has chosen to spearhead neo-Nazis into positions of authority. Under a regime of indirect rule, however, they take their orders on crucial military and foreign policy issues, including the deployment of troops directed against the Russian Federation, from the U.S. State Department, the Pentagon, and NATO. A scenario of military escalation leading to confrontation of Russia and NATO is a distinct possibility. The Ukraine's National Security and National Defense Committee, RNBOU, which is controlled by neo-Nazis, plays a central role in military affairs. In the confrontation with Moscow, decisions taken by the RNBOU, headed by neo-Nazi Andriy Poroby and his brown-shirt deputy Dmytro Yarosh, in consultation with Washington and Brussels, could potentially have devastating consequences. That's from the neoliberal neo-Nazi coup in Ukraine. The world is at a dangerous crossroads, a transcription of a GRTV interview with Michel Chossudovsky, posted March 13th. What McCain fails to realize is that this is not Afghanistan and Obama is not in a spitting match with puppet Karzai. Leveling sanctions against Moscow will have significant consequences, the likes of which could cause real harm to U.S. interests. Any confrontation with Russia will result in asymmetrical attacks on the dollar, the bond market, and oil supplies. Maybe the U.S. could defeat Russian forces in the Crimea. Maybe they could sink the fleet and rout the troops, but there will be a heavy price to pay, and no one will be happy with the outcome. That's from Russia-Ukraine Geopolitics, Big Oil's Drive to War, by Mike Whitney, posted March 12th, originally appearing in Counterpunch. Obama declared that Washington and the international community would completely reject the referendum to be held Sunday in Crimea on secession from Ukraine and affiliation with the Russian Federation. He reiterated the U.S. demand that Russia withdraw its forces from Crimea and recognize the new right-wing anti-Russian regime in Kiev, which was installed last month in a U.S. and European Union-backed coup led by armed fascist militias. The U.S. would impose new sanctions if Russia refused to comply with these demands, Obama said, claiming that the international community will be forced to apply a cost to what he called Russian violations of international law. Obama also declared that Ukraine, quote, cannot have an outside country dictate to them how to manage their affairs, unquote, and added that the, quote, interests of the U.S. are solely to ensure that the people of Ukraine are able to determine their own destiny, unquote. This is presumably why the U.S. poured billions of dollars into assembling proxy forces in the country and handpicked yachts, in the memorable words of U.S. State Department official Victoria Nuland, to succeed Yanukovych. That's from the article, Obama Issues New Threats Against Russia, Military Action Contemplated, by Chris Marsden, posted March 13th, originally appearing at the World Socialist website. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. It can be a challenge to make sense of the situation in Ukraine. Much of the media coverage has been slanted and misleading. Journalists are called on to try to provide a context for the events unfolding and not just faithfully relay the utterances of world leaders. Recent mobilizations seem to be bringing us closer to the brink of another military conflict. Who are the players and what are they trying to achieve? We contacted a previous interview guest to help guide us through the Ukraine puzzle. I'm now joined on the line by Rick Rozoff. He is based in Chicago and an active opponent of war and militarism. He manages the Stop NATO listserv and website and is also a frequent contributor to Global Research. Rick, there's been a number of developments in Ukraine since we last spoke a month ago. Sniper killings in late February, which apparently led to the departure of President Yanukovych. An interim government sworn in and given recognition by the West, and Russian troops have moved into Crimea, and now there's a referendum in play to determine the fate of Crimea. So I was wondering if you might be able to help put into context some of these events. When we spoke last time, you talked about how there was an encroachment by NATO, sort of a steady encroachment, cutting Russia off from the Mediterranean area and relegating Russia to just basically status as a Pacific Rim country. Do the events of the last few weeks sort of confirm that analysis?
they not only confirm it, but to an alarming degree, they reinforce the basic point with now a military component. Pardon me, you know, everything that has come to pass was frighteningly predictable and was predicted. I mean, that's exactly what we discussed last time around, Michael, yourself and I, and also your other guest, Eric Dreitzer, that it was, you know, transparently evident. It was, I want to say, repulsively evident that with the leaked audio tape of the State Department's Victoria Nuland, and with their discussion with U.S. Ambassador to Kiev, Jeffrey Pyatt, that they had already handpicked a post-coup junta, and that, you know, Arseniy Yatsenyuk was going to be the chief prime minister. There are three, technically, in Ukraine, but he was going to be de facto the head of state as well as head of government in that capacity, and that's come about, exactly. And then what does Mr. Yatsenyuk do no sooner than he's installed in that position? He goes to Brussels to meet with EU officials, but more alarmingly, to hold a press conference with the Secretary General of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, at which point, you know, the two chums discuss, amongst other things, a visit of the North Atlantic Council, which is the highest planning body, the highest executive body of NATO. It's comprised of the 28 ambassadors of the respective NATO states, invites them to come to Kiev for the first time ever. And then what we've seen in the last week, which is really the most serious cause for concern, is U.S. announcing a massive deployment of military hardware to countries bordering Russia. And we're speaking, of course, about 10 F-15s to go to Lithuania to patrol the three Baltic states, Lithuania, Estonia, Latvia. We're talking about F-16s coming to Poland, NATO AWACS aircraft to monitor the borders of Poland and Ukraine and Romania and Ukraine, U.S. Guided missile warship coming into the Black Sea for war games with Bulgaria and Romania. This goes on and on. And it perhaps culminates today in, you know, would-be President of the United States, John McCain, being quoted in Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and Voice of America, calling for, he can't touch Ukraine directly, of course, at this point, but he's calling for Georgia and Moldova to be fast-tracked into NATO. And he's talking about, you know, reverting back to the George W. Bush administration's plans to place intermediate-range missiles in Poland and the Czech Republic. So this is what we're talking about in the interim. But the pieces do fit together. Mm. And what it suggests is a U.S. coup was meant, and that's what it was, U.S. and EU NATO-engineered coup in Kiev earlier this year, was designed to affect several major objectives for the West. Energy projects, certainly. There was a New York Times article roughly a week ago suggesting the U.S. wants to sell shale oil to Ukraine in lieu of Russian, oil and gas to Ukraine in lieu of the Russian version. And there are, you know, several geopolitical objectives, but what we're seeing right now is heavily the military component of it.
Now, I know that these sorts of geopolitical maneuverings have been compared to a chess game. Of course, we both remember that famous book by Zbigniew Brzezinski, the Grand Chessboard. And in chess, it's common that you anticipate what your opponent's moves are going to be. So, I mean, the Russian move into Crimea came as no big shock to you. No doubt it was not really a big shock to the West, in spite of all of the bluster that we hear in the media. With the path that's been taken, are you able to kind of look ahead to your future moves, or are we what's the next the next shots that we can expect over the coming weeks?
There are several possibilities. Keeping in mind this is, you know, game theory, if you will. It's very dangerous brinkmanship, where one tests the nerves of an opponent or presumptive opponent, testing their defenses in many instances, seeing how they react, seeing if they'll fall into a trap. So it's far more sophisticated than simply a linear, you know, series of moves. But things that could have been easily predicted, for example, and that, you know, many of us have been talking about for decades, literally for decades. In November of last year, right ahead of the crisis developing in Ukraine, that is when the Yanukovych government deferred its decision to sign an association agreement with the European Union under the auspices of the Eastern Partnership Program, The very same Victoria Nuland, Assistant Secretary of State for European and Eurasian Affairs, made a statement to the U.S. media. It was covered by Radio Free Europe, stating that this was an, how does she put it, Moldova, Georgia, and Ukraine are on a fast track or on a, you know, unstoppable progress, towards Western integration. It's interesting she mentioned those three countries because if you throw the fourth party into that, Azerbaijan, those are the four nations that have been known under the acronym of GWAM. That's Georgia, Ukraine, Azerbaijan, Moldova. It was an initiative set up by the Clinton administration 20 years ago for energy transport purposes, basically to drive Russia out of the European energy market, but also for military purposes. That's a critical area from Azerbaijan on the Caspian Sea to Ukraine on the Black Sea. And what we can anticipate, I think, very clearly, just recently, a parliamentary delegation from the former Soviet Republic of Moldova, the M in Guam, was at NATO headquarters. It was reported on yesterday, where NATO reasserted its support for the territorial integrity of Moldova. The former Soviet Republic of Moldova, a part of it broke away even before the full dissolution of the Soviet Union. It's one of the so-called four frozen conflicts in former Soviet space. I've always argued Crimea is the fifth. You have Transdniester is the name of it, and has Moldova, which has been, the victim of a color revolution 5 years ago, the so-called Twitter revolution of 2009, which brought into power not only a pro-NATO, pro-U.S. government, but one that, you know, clearly backs or favors the absorption of Moldova into Romania, which is a full NATO member, which is currently exercising with the U.S. Navy in the Black Sea, right off the shore of Ukraine. And that on the west of Transdniester, however, is Ukraine, or the east, rather. And I think, I fear that what's going to happen now is there may be a warm-up exercise by the west and threats to or even military moves against the small political entity of Transdniester. Seeing how that goes, and if Russia tolerates it, then here's the chess game, thinking of a move ahead. If they don't do anything about that, then Crimea may be the next target.
We've seen the sanctions, the threat of sanctions by the West against Russia, and I believe I heard Putin at one point mention retaliation in the form of dumping the dollar. What is your assessment of retaliation against that aspect, the economic guns being held to the head of the Russians?
I don't want to dismiss the significance of it, but again, when we talk about patterns that have gone unnoticed or uncommented on, and I'm afraid it's so far advanced, it's going to take a heroic and almost unprecedented effort to reverse these trends. Let's take a case in point. If Russia takes an initiative of some sort, it is almost incumbent upon Russia to be able to persuade other nations in the world to fall into line or to cooperate with it. I had occasion the other day on a radio program to discuss the fact that in every major vote that's taken in the General Assembly of the United Nations on the initiative of the United States and its allies, and I'm thinking of the one of May of last year on Syria, there are 194 members of the United Nations right now, if you include South Sudan. Of those 194, only 12 voted against the U.S. and Saudi-based resolution. And I underline that, please. Of 194 nations, only 12 nations in the world will vote against the United States on an issue of that sort. 59 abstain, including most of the BRICS countries, Brazil, South Africa, and India. But to abstain under those circumstances is really to give a backhanded support to the United States, in my estimate. And that the situation has evolved in the post-Cold War period where, Russia is not receiving international support for its position on Ukraine. Let's be honest about it. Even China is not supporting the Russian position on this. And we have to reverse that situation, first of all, by making people conscious about it, right? This is not an attempt to lead to defeatism or anything of the sort. But I think there is a naive, Pollyannish view that somehow, for example, the European Union is a counterbalance to the United States. Anyone who ever believed that, please, against the backdrop of the Ukrainian crisis, that's a patent absurdity. And that the major Western powers are working in absolute unison. They may have slight tactical differences on questions like Iraq and so forth, but when it comes down to Western, the plans for a continuation of Western domination of the world, there is, not even enough difference between them to let the light through. And we have to be very clear about what we're combating. You know, major academics recently, Michael, have written articles about how, you know, Germany is working with Russia on the Ukraine crisis. Let's remember who delivered the coup de grace to Yanukovych in Kiev a few weeks ago. They were the foreign ministers of France, Germany, and Poland, the so-called Weimar Triangle. And these are the people who came in and laid down the law to Mr. Yanukovych and were, you know, basically, you know, set up the final act, if you will, in this tragedy that allowed the extremists, the nationalists, the fascists to come to power in Ukraine.
What about that that presence of these extreme nationalists, the ultra nationalists, fascists, as you call them? What kind of a factor do they present? Are they potentially going to destabilize the whole situation? Are we looking at a kind of a civil war that further complicates this mess?
You know, I hate to say it, because of the Ukrainian people will be caught in the crossfire, of course, at least those in the west of the country. And on their behalf, you know, I sincerely hope that does not occur. However, there would be an almost poetic act of poetic justice should something like that occur. Look, this question about the ultranationalists is a two-edged sword, and we should be clear about it. If there wasn't the presence, you know, the right sector and other neo-Nazi and affiliated or, you know, aligned organizations, we wouldn't even be having this discussion because nobody would care. In other words, the worst-case scenario possibly would have been if the same situation, the same, you know, regime change had been affected by a group of choir boys and Boy Scouts, you know, who were impeccable with their democratic credentials and so forth and overthrew an elected government and led to the situation we're talking about right now, then we wouldn't even be able to rally people around the fact that there are, you know, swastikas flying in Kiev. That would have been a more dangerous scenario, truthfully. The fact that, you know, the opposition has exposed itself is being what it is, you know, makes our job a little bit easier. Not that ultimately, as we know, the Western media or Western governments really care. I mean, if somebody you know, came with a mustache and you know, putting his right arm in the air, the Yatsenyuk started imitating Adolf Hitler, it wouldn't mean a bit of difference in Washington or Brussels or in the editorial offices of the New York Times or the London Times. Unfortunately, we know that. But you know, we can rally ordinary people whose sense of history has not been completely destroyed, and whose moral sensibilities haven't been, you know, neutralized at this point to respond largely because of this neo-Nazi component. You know, heaven forbid they had pulled this off without it.
Now, recalling about a century ago, we saw the beginning of World War I and a demonstration of how things can sometimes escalate out of control and you can end up in a very, very dire an extremely violent conflict. How big a risk is there of something similar happening here with Ukraine and this confrontation? And you know, what are the stakes?
I think there's a catastrophic risk of something snowballing beyond the control. However, I just have to say, you know, people in the West, in the U.S. and its NATO allies, of course, you know, have proven over the past couple of decades they'll run any risk. You know, the risk of a nuclear confrontation, if need be, and you know, they're playing a very, very dangerous group of version rather of brinkmanship. I didn't see it a few days ago, that former Ohio Congressman Dennis Kucinich was on the Bill O'Reilly show. And that O'Reilly was, you know, taunting him and baiting him and, the Russophobic tirade of some sort. And Kucinich, you know, just calmly said, look, if I need to discuss with you the principle of cause and effect, then, you're beyond reclamation. We can't go any further. In other words, every action brings about some kind of reaction, you know, if not an equal and opposite one. And that, you know, the Russian move in Crimea was eminently foreseeable. But the trick with Western governments and news, they're obedient to news media, is to always and everywhere present the reaction as the action, you know, as the precipitating action, and that's of course not the case. So what are we hearing? That the Russian move into Crimea, and I've yet to determine what they mean by the Russian move into Crimea. The way you hear it in the Western media, you would think a Russian army had moved in there. You know, hundreds of thousands of troops had moved in, and nothing of the sort has occurred. if there has been a reinforcement of the Russian military contingent at the headquarters of the Russian Black Sea Fleet in Crimea, it's, you know, that's, I think, is the extent of it at this point. But the comparisons have been made to Czechoslovakia, say, in 1968, because it's portrayed as the Russians unilaterally and with no purpose other than their own viciousness, you know, attacking an independent country, Ukraine in this instance, and you know, in the territory of Crimea. Whereas, I think you intimated earlier, Michael, that what we're looking at is something far more evocative of the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962 than it is of the Czechoslovak crisis in 1968. That's why the world really needs to be aware of the full repercussions of actions being taken right now. When, again, this military buildup, and I understand that some of the exercises, the one in the Black Sea currently, the naval drills, had been planned in advance, but the fact that the U.S. is sending 10 F-15s to the Baltic region, this was an unplanned. This is in addition to taking over the six-month rotation of the air patrols over the Baltics. And the U.S. has, you know, for years talked about shifting F-16 planes from the Aviano Air Force Base in Italy to Poland, but they choose precisely this moment to do it. And then to kind of cap all this off, you were mentioning Zbigniew Brzezinski. He was quoted on a Polish news site yesterday or the preceding day, stating that the current foreign minister of Poland, Radoslaw Sikorski, would be an excellent secretary general of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, especially now against the backdrop of the Ukrainian crisis. So for people who are averse to looking at the geopolitical aspect of these developments, listen to, you know, the geostrategist, the grand chess board, grand chess master himself, Brzezinski, because he's telling you what the truth is.
So assuming you are successful in bringing this kind of analysis to the forefront, I mean, what do you see the public being able to do anything to reverse course or defuse the situation?
Yeah, there are two questions here. Whether we can be instrumental in changing public thinking. And I believe, yes, I mean, one by one, incrementally we can. We don't have access to. You know, I'm speaking as somebody who tried to respond to an article in the New York Times in their blog section, about as obscure a part of it as you could get, identified myself as the manager of the Stop NATO list, and they wouldn't even post my comment. So, you know, we're limited in who we can reach, and they ensure that we're limited in who we can reach. You know, as much as they criticize the media in other countries, I don't know of any more, you know, limited and constricted than that here in the United States. But second of all, though, we have to, another development over the in the post-Cold War era is the increased de-democratization, if you will, of the political systems within the West itself, to the point that if you had a congressional district where the electorate thought and voiced its support 95% in favor of one issue, that doesn't guarantee that their representative is going to vote in that manner. There are larger overriding considerations, not only donors, you know, who have bought these people, but political lobbies who, you know, whip them into line obediently, so that even if we have a massive change in public opinion on a given issue, that's not a guarantee right now, given the structural limitations of so-called democracy in the West, that any political change will come out of that. So we have a, you know, tall order ahead of us. There's no question about it. We are called upon to do, you know, informational organizing and the dissemination of political, not only information, but analysis. And we're also, you know, called upon in many ways to work for the transformation of the political system, so it's in some manner reflective of public opinion. It is not right now.
Well, Rick Rozoff, yours is always a very sane and intelligent analysis, and we're very grateful for that. So I want to thank you very much for joining us on the Global Research News Hour.
Yeah, thank you once again for having me.
And we've been speaking with Rick Rozoff, who's based in Chicago, anti-war and anti-militarism activist and manager of the Stop NATO listserv and website. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Ukrainians in the Crimea will be voting in a referendum on March 16th to determine whether to join Russia or stay an independent state. Western leaders say they will not recognize the result of such a referendum. John Ryan, a retired geography professor and senior scholar at the University of Winnipeg, recently wrote an article arguing such a referendum is as legitimate as the referenda on Quebec sovereignty in Canada. He joined me recently to discuss this view further. John Ryan, thank you for joining us here on the Global Research News Hour.
Well, thank you for having me.
Quebec is considered a distinct society within Canada. Is Crimea similarly distinct in Ukraine?
Well, I was quite astounded at Obama and the Ukraine, of course, Britain, all saying this is, referendum is illegal. As if it, they were saying that for it to be legal, all the people in Ukraine would have to vote at it. And right away I realized this is rubbish and nonsense, because in Canada we've had two referenda, 1980, 1995, and a third one may be coming up. Scotland is having a referendum in the near future for independence. And it was, nobody ever complained about this. Only the people in Quebec were the ones who voted. And Quebec, as a province of Canada, decided on their own to hold a referendum. Ottawa never objected to it, and the Americans never objected to it. Now suddenly there's this big brouhaha, this is illegal. Well, the United Nations Charter says that all peoples have a right to national self-determination if they form a majority in an area. Well, the people in Crimea form a majority. And especially since what triggered the entire thing was after the takeover of the government, they threw out Yanukovych. The day afterwards, or the very same day, they banned the use of Russian as an official language.
And that's pretty significant for this
area. Well, 97% of the people in Crimea speak Russian. 60% are Russian, pure Russian, but 97% of the people speak Russian. That would be the equivalent of Ottawa banning the use of French in Canada. If they banned the use of French as a second language, how long do you think it would be before Quebec would declare a referendum? I mean, so I wrote an article based on this. I said, if Quebec has the right to do this, surely Crimea has the equivalent autonomy to a Canadian province, as far as I understand. And if Quebec can do this, why not Crimea? So that was the point of my article.
Okay. I know that, of course, among the voices of outrage about the supposed illegality of this referendum was a former Prime Minister, Brian Mulroney. He spoke on the House on CBC. He was interviewed by Evan Solomon. I'm just going to play you a clip of what he had to say to this question.
There's no such thing as a referendum in these circumstances where an occupying power comes in and says, we are going to puts in a dummy prime minister in government and says we are going to have a referendum in the next 15 days as to whether you want to rejoin Russia or stay within Ukraine. No one in his right mind would give this any credibility at all.
Nobody in their right mind would give any credibility to this. Well, what do you think about the prime minister's...
Well, we'll see what happens. I mean, what did he do about Quebec's referendum? What did he say about it? Mm-hmm. The thing that I found peculiar and unusual in the Crimea case is the swiftness of the referendum. They should have delayed this. They should have delayed it. But the point was that in their parliament, 78 members voted in favor of it. And they weren't coerced in any way by Russians to do this. Seven or eight people abstained. Nobody voted against it. So you have the equivalent, say, of Quebec, if everybody unanimously voted for it. Well, that's their decision, I suppose. We will see what's going to happen. I doubt that they will actually join Russia in this. I think they may, because they have two choices, to join Russia or declare essentially independence, an autonomous region, but still belong to Ukraine. I think they will opt for the second one. But we will see.
The Prime Minister made reference to the troop presence, the presence of Russians in Crimea, and how, you know, and of course, like, as you mentioned it yourself, the short time frame. And I wonder if that doesn't bring an element of unfairness to the whole situation. I mean, Quebec, I mean, yeah. when Quebec had their referenda, there was a long time frame.
I know, and there were no Canadian troops there.
Yeah. So that does
that. I admit that. But these are unusual circumstances. I mean, look at the coup that occurred in Ukraine. I mean, here was a Yanukovych. Sure, he was crooked. But the point is that every government since Ukraine's independence was crooked and corrupt. It was Putin who actually kicked out the oligarchs in Russia, and they have a far greater degree of democracy in Russia than they ever did in Ukraine, because it was the oligarchs who essentially controlled everything in Ukraine, and they still do. Even now, with this new regime, they appointed a multi-huge, one of the richest people in the world, as governor of one of the very pro-Russian states in the eastern part of Ukraine. Now, where's the democracy in that kind of thing? So you have this kind of a situation. In any event, they took over. They didn't follow the constitution in getting rid of Yanukovych. They could have had another election within a year. And on the 21st of February, Yanukovych relinquished all kinds of powers. They signed an agreement, witnessed by Germany, Poland, I've forgotten who, and he pulled the police out. As soon as he pulled the police out, these people in Maiden Square, the bulk of these Svoboda and right sector people, took over the parliament, government buildings, threatened the members in parliament, and suddenly they were the government. Well, this was a coup d'etat of the first order. And the thing that really upsets me is to say that the right-wing groups are just form a minority. Come on now, just take a look at who they are. A 21-seat cabinet, 8 of them come from Svoboda and the right sector. And Svoboda and the right sector are fascists and neo-Nazis, no matter how you whitewash them. These are the people who still glorify Bandura. Bandura headed divisions
Nazi
of
collaborator.
Nazi collaborator killed countless. They cleaned out the entire city of Lviv. In Lviv, Ukrainians only formed something like 25% of the population. The rest were Poles and Jews. They killed them all off. Mm-hmm. And Hitler was going to have them administer the country after he took it all over. Just last summer, for heaven's sake, Svoboda had people dressed in full Nazi uniforms glorifying Bandura and the people who fought the Soviet army. And the other thing that really upset me is when all this occurred, they demolished all the monuments.
To Lenin.
Not to Lenin only. The monuments commemorating the defeat of Nazi Germany. The monuments commemorating the defeat of Nazi Germany. All of these were destroyed. Now, what the hell goes on here? And to say that these form a minority, they hold the senior most positions. Yarosh, the leader of the right sector party, is in charge of the police and security. And in all likelihood, it is Yarosh's party the snipers who killed off these people. This is another thing. You know, they blame Yanukovych, his police, for killing all kinds of people. Great outrage, he's killing his own people. Well, there was an intercepted phone call between the foreign minister of Estonia, and Lady Ashton, who is the head of the foreign affairs in the European Union, in which the foreign minister of Estonia said when he was there, there was a Ukrainian doctor who tried to help the people who were shot. Olga Balogovsky or whatever her name was. And she said these people were shot by the same types of rifles. And the only people there who had comparable assault rifles were people in the right sector party. And now they're saying it's the Russians who did it. No, come on, though, get some sanity. Why would Putin and the Russians come in there and kill people in order to throw out Yanukovych and put these people in power? No, does that make any sense?
So you're alluding, I mean, the circumstances under which Yanukovych was removed. And
yes.
There's
they didn't follow procedure of the Constitution. There was an impeachment procedure. All that was ignored.
So it's basically you're alluding to, I guess we could call it, an inconsistency in terms of the governments and referenda that the West recognizes as legitimate.
Of course. I mean, they recognize this as a legitimate government, and this is a coup d'etat of the first order. They had one in Egypt. America never called it a coup, but surely it was. They had a coup in Honduras. America refused to recognize it. Well, I mean, they're specialists in coups.
Professor Ryan, as far as this situation is evolving is concerned, is there anything more that you think people need to...
Well, I'll tell you. The whole thing started when Yanukovych refused to sign a trade deal with the European Union. And when he said, no, he's not going to do this, he's going to opt for a deal with Russia, that's when the demonstration started. Well, let's just take a look at what it is that Yanukovych turned down. What was it Europe offered him? They offered him for business and people, they'd have to double the price of electricity and natural gas. Pensions would have to be reduced by half. The school children, the funds for schools would be reduced. And the agricultural land would have to be made open for purchase by big corporations. And they offered them $4 billion for all that. Putin, on the other hand, instead of increasing natural gas prices, he offered to reduce them by a third and offered them $15 billion, no strings attached. Well, so they object to this. They want to carry on negotiations. Okay, you can carry on negotiations, but what are you going to get in return? I mean, so now, and then Putin said, look, let's work this out in a three-way deal. Europe, us, and Ukraine. They flatly refused to do it. The point is that in the eastern part of Ukraine, the bulk of the industries, they have practically everything that's exported is sold to Russia. If they break off trade relations with Russia, who are they going to sell these goods to? They're all going to go bankrupt in the way they did in East Germany. And people know that. If I can add one more thing.
Yes, please.
New York Times ran a big story that in conversations with Angela Merkel, she said that Putin was somehow detached, living in a different universe. Well, the German chancellery took great exception to that. It appeared in German newspapers. All that she said is he had a different interpretation of what occurred in Crimea. This was all propaganda to distort and destroy Putin, that he's crazy. And so you can say, well, he's crazy because Angela Merkel said so. And the Germans deny this. But, of course, the propaganda wagon is on the road.
Yes, and set loose.
Yeah. Okay.
Professor Ryan, thank you very much for that analysis and your continued support. And look forward
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. That's Professor John Ryan, retired professor of geography at the University of Winnipeg and a senior scholar there as well. It is hard to get a sense of the situation in Ukraine given existing media coverage with propaganda on all sides. Someone with a sense of how reality can be distorted by current news coverage is Felicity Arbuthnot. Felicity Arbuthnot is a London-based freelance print and broadcast journalist and also a frequent contributor to Global Research. Felicity, thank you very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Now, I know that you're principally known for your coverage of Iraq, going back to the 1990s and the early sanctions period.
The embargo, yeah.
Could you are there any similarities that you're noticing between the way the West is approaching the current situation in Ukraine and what you remember from Iraq back in the early days?
Yes, I think broadly it's the disinformation, the demonization. I notice now that even President Putin is a fairly, whatever one thinks about, you know, his background, he's a fairly level-headed man, but he's the new Hitler, as was Saddam, and then Colonel Gaddafi, and it, you know, it goes on and on. Milosevic, of course, in Yugoslavia. The other thing is that all of these places are absolutely strategically, in America's eyes, in my opinion, vital. I mean, Iraq was, you know, incredible strategic place, where it is sort of center of the Middle East, and very powerful and independent-minded. I mean, when Saddam played his final card, which signed his death warrant, in my opinion, in 2000, and even in the embargo, he still had one to play, which was to switch to selling the oil from dollars into euros. Right, so that's that. But then there's the immense wealth of Iraq in mainly oil, but it's now thought some gas. That also that applied to Libya, of course. Syria, there's the same demonization and the same destabilization. One had, you know, all sorts of games going on. You had the Iraq National Congress in Iraq, which was funded to the tune of millions and millions and millions by the CIA. You've now got the same destabilization going on in Syria with people funded by Britain and America, allegedly, through Saudi Arabia and Qatar mainly. And you have people there from 80 different countries at least, and this is pretty well confirmed. And that really is an important point here. In 2006, at Christmas, a man called William Roebuck, who was director for State Department Office of Near East Affairs and was based in Damascus and in the embassy, which was still open then, he wrote an end-of-year strategy letter. It was sort of roundup of, you know, what Syria's like at the moment under the new, much more outlooking and Western orientated Assad. And he said his popularity had absolutely soared, quote, throughout the region. And the subject title of his memo to Washington was Influencing the Syrian Arab Regime Government at the End of 2006. And he said the government ends 2006 in a much stronger position domestically and internationally. And then he talked about President Assad's growing self-confidence, quote-unquote, and he felt that this might lead to mistakes and ill-judged decisions, providing us with new opportunities. Whilst traditional bilateral or multilateral pressure can impact on Syria. And then he went on to say, this cable summarizes our assessment of vulnerabilities and suggests that there may be actions, statements, and signals that the U.S. government can send that will improve the likelihood of such opportunities arising. These proposals would need to be, quote, fleshed out and converted into real actions, and we need to be ready to move quickly to take advantage of such opportunities.
There's an appearance of a bit of a double standard, I guess. There's we've got this upcoming referendum where all the Western sources are saying, well, no, it's not at all legitimate. But then they were very quick to I'm talking about the Western countries, very quick to recognize the governing authority in Ukraine. So
absolutely. And I mean, Sudan was bombed into having a referendum. It's the double standards are absolutely staggering. Ukraine is, and we keep hearing this stuff about, I was thinking of this from about six different ways. We keep hearing about, you know, sovereignty and territorial integrity and how Russia, this terrible bogeyman, the new Hitler, you know, is negating this. Actually, Russia has had a perfectly amicable agreement with Ukraine to have its Black Sea fleet moored off Sevastopol for years, and it was recently, a few years ago, extended to 2042. That includes allowing Russia in Crimea to use the airspace as well. So it's actually, you know, they're not going against anything. And the majority of the people of Ukraine, it looks, Crimea, it looks like at the moment, are absolutely shaking in their boots at some of the pronouncements that have come out of the new endorsed, which was, it was the most outrageous overthrow government, which has overthrown a government which was elected, absolutely, whatever its view, it was elected. And I mean, there's one deputy that's come out and he said, he won't, by the way, he went into Parliament brandishing an AK-47 and then said that he wouldn't rest until every Russian, every Jew and every black was driven from the Ukraine. These are the people we're backing, the most ultra, ultra right. There's another one who actually founded, he's a great admirer of Joseph Goebbels, and he even founded a think tank originally called the Joseph Goebbels Political Research Center. I mean, you really have to pinch yourself that we're backing this incredible far right, I mean, far, far, far right, emerging as a dominant voice in an illegal overthrow.
What, sort of following up on that point, you're seeing a kind of a growing, ethnic divide within Ukraine, and it seems to me that that's sort of something similar like that happened, and we saw that happening in Yugoslavia and Iraq and other countries. Is this sort of like a pattern that's being
there
replicated?
An absolute pattern. It's funny enough, you've picked up on exactly what I was sort of jotting down before we started to talk. In Iraq, until a very brief bit of history, in 1959, there was a personal status law which made the legal age for marriage 18. Forced marriages were banned, polygamy was restricted, cohesion between communities was enhanced and fostered by, quote unquote, eliminating the differential treatment of Sunnis and Shia under the law, and also erasing the differentiation between various religious communities. And women's right in divorce, child custody, inheritance were an absolute integral part of the law. And Article 14 stated that all Iraqis were equal under law, unless you messed with Saddam, of course, when he came on. But that was all it was ever thus. But from the first day, and this is absolutely mirrors what's happened everywhere else, when George Bush, on day one of the invasion, and his administration started to talk of Sunni, Shia, Kurds, Christians, other religions, ethnicities, and if you remember, effectively selecting the sort of, proxy overseers of the quote-unquote new Iraq, not by ability, but by religion and ethnicity. From day one, they pitched Iraqi against Iraqi. In what, for all the sort of layeral complexities of Iraq and indeed the region, it had been an extraordinarily cohesive society. It was divide and rule writ large. And by the way, when he kept going on about the Sunni-dominated government, actually the majority of the government were Shia, and on the wanted people, on these ridiculous childish playing cards, if you remember, on Iraq's Most Wanted that was issued after the invasion, 37 of the 52 were Shia. I mean, that proves the point. And this is what they're doing. It's already happened in Ukraine, although this is, this overthrow is very recent. It is a pattern. You're absolutely right.
Now, you brought up Syria earlier, and it looked like last year, just judging by the media coverage, I just had this sense, oh boy, here we go again, because it seemed like there was this avalanche of coverage showing, look at all these, the gassing of all these civilians and so on, and you could just see it coming. And my sense is that this time around, people weren't falling for it as much, and that must have figured into the decision not to go ahead first in Great Britain and then the rest of the world. Is like popular, the wider populations are not going to go for it again. Is that your sense as well?
They didn't buy it this time, did they? But I also think that one of the reasons for demonizing, an additional reason for demonizing Putin, is because he wasn't have it. If you remember, he and the Chinese stuck together in the Security Council, and they just weren't having it. Because he was drawn into Libya, wasn't he? There wasn't a veto on that. And I think they kicked themselves. But I agree with you entirely. I agree. So they haven't got away with Syria yet. But God, I mean, the way Ukraine just leapt onto us, it came out of the blue. It wasn't on anybody's radar.
Well, given the current realities, I mean, what are you anticipating in terms of the direction this situation goes?
What, in Ukraine?
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what, she says with some caution. I truly think they've bitten off a huge unknown, both in those they're dealing with, you know, and we haven't got time to go in the background of, you know, the main players, but as I said, they're really scary, scary people. But the other thing is that, for instance, you know, they keep yelling this knee-jerk embargo, 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 and we'll embargo Russia. You know, they're certainly trying to encircle Russia. There's no question about that. But Putin has already said, well, we'll just switch out and we won't trade with dollars in the dollar anymore. I mean, that would have huge significance. America's not very well off at the moment. They had to, if you remember, grovel around, didn't they, for just $30 million last November, was it? $30 billion, sorry. So Putin has said, you know, one move and we'll switch from the dollar. As far as the EU is concerned, France alone has 6,000 companies working that operate out of Russia. Germany has a huge amount. The trade between Russia and America is, and God knows America's, you know, in trillions in debt, is substantial. I think, you know, I really think that, I think I wrote a couple of days ago, that, you know, embargoing Russia would be shooting yourself in both feet, both hands and the head. I mean, it is absolutely insane. And I mean, John Kerry, who after all is supposed to be a diplomat, diplomacy seems to have gone out of the window too, and William Hague, you know, sort of throw their toys out of the pram and say, we're not going to speak to Putin, you know, like kids in a playground. Well, you know, Kerry increasingly sounds like a sort of, I don't know, Wild West cowboy. You know, what happened to diplomacy? What happened to statesmanship? I kind of despair for the West, actually.
Okay. Well, Felicity, on that rather sad note, it's really been a pleasure speaking with you and getting your take on this whole situation. I want to thank you very much for being my guest on the Global Research News Hour.
It's a great pleasure. Anytime.
Felicity Arbuthnot, London-based freelance journalist and a frequent contributor to the Global Research website. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across the country. We are broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.